Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential. Hello again, Eric Anderson, Editor-in-Chief of Awards Watch. We've missed you for the last couple of weeks.
I know, and so much has happened since then. It's like 1 month or even 2 months go by, and it's about 6 months worth of content.
It is, and I have a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about to get your thoughts on this week. Industry news, some major controversies, awards news, and of course, Timothée Chalamet. We're going to get into it all. I'm going to start because first I want to quote someone. I want to quote the great Eric Anderson, who recently took to the institution of discourse called Twitter to write, "I don't know who's worse, the you have to see it in the theater people or the ones shaming the ones who do go." So this is the discourse now, right?
You know, it was a subtweet to be sure, because there's just this weird conversation happening. And it's all within peer groups, which is kind of unfortunate. And that is the, you know, the folks that are, you know, you have to see Dune in a theater, anything else is just not, you know, worth it. And then you have the other side, which is, well, you know, there are plenty of people that can't go to a theater, and which are both great arguments to have, but the nature of the argument and the language is more of shaming the other side, another person, rather than explaining and talking about reasons for and reasons against. So it's no different really than political discourse too, where the only avenue of discussion is cut off right at the beginning, because you're not opening it up for discussion. You're just saying you're wrong, it's like this, and anything that you say just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So that was my kind of comment, to be just like, You're both doing the exact same thing. You're not engaging in a conversation or a discourse. You're just throwing up this border that is uncrossable for you. So you're not trying to look at anything. You're just trying to kind of be a jerk.
Right. And one of the things that to discuss here also is the box office, because in fact, this week's American box office with Dune, for example, even though it was day and date on HBO Max as well, it went pretty well, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what inspired this new round of this conversation, because we've had now a handful of blockbusters in the United States that have started to do pretty well. And again, people just kind of, they start to bristle, and they start to get, I don't know, like personally weirded out or offended. It's hard to tell sometimes. I mean, I did engage in some of that conversation. Some of it was healthy, and then some of it was really not, because it was just about, you know, you're coming from a point of privilege and you're looking at things through your own lens. But if your point when you come back is looking at something purely from your own lens, it's kind of funny to say that and to, you know, project that onto somebody else. But yeah, I mean, the box office in the United States is starting to come back. We certainly have to reevaluate what we can define as a success in this era. But, you know, if something costs $200 million and, you know, it costs millions and millions and millions more on top of that to market and to everything that it takes to run a campaign for a film, you know, a $40 million opening, I don't think is that great. It's kind of strange how it was painted as a really big success. It doesn't feel like a big success for Dune, speaking specifically for Dune, because we've had No Time to Die. We've had other films that have hit higher numbers than that. And of course, you know, we have to also look at international box office when you're talking about any of these type of movies, because all of that budget and marketing, it's not just limited to the United States totals, but we kind of, you know, the U.S. is very U.S. centric.
Oh, really?
Shockingly so. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. It only matters what we think. So when we look at something like box office, the focus is almost always on domestic. And, you know, we have to look at the rest too, and how much that counters any arguments that we make.
Looking at the speciality box office, it was wonderful news, I understand, and that the French Dispatch opened in only 52 theaters and made $1.3 million. And just imagine how the expansion to 600 theaters will be. So people do want to go back to the theater, even for the smaller pictures.
It could be. It'll be really interesting to see, because we saw September and most of October just be miserable for the art house crowd and for those types of films. French Dispatch and Lamb from A24 are bucking the trend of that. But then, you know, something like The Eyes of Tammy Faye or Mass has not been able to do what I think they could probably do in a quote unquote normal and non-pandemic year. So I think it's going to remain extremely difficult for those types of films, for art house theaters in general, which have been able to survive pretty well over the last few years, even as we rely on streaming so much and theaters rely on tentpole franchises so much. They've still been able to do well, but in this industry, there isn't going to be, you know, a group that's hit more hard by closures and by the pandemic than an art house theater.
But in all, it's been a good, positive weekend. And how much can we attribute to Timmy, who's in both of these movies?
You know, it's
Timothy, or should I continue saying Timothée?
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, Timothée Chalamet is in both of these movies that we just mentioned.
He is. It's a good weekend to be Timmy, on top of his, you know, Wonka stuff and all of that. So he's having a good time and a good period. And he's not exactly a box office king by any stretch of the imagination. There's nothing that's led to him being one. So just being the face of these two movies, even though obviously French Dispatch is a very large ensemble, has kind of given him this status, either real or artificial. I'm not really sure yet. It's going to take other things to kind of establish if he has any real box office prowess or not.
But it's kind of nice. Both Timothy and our Oscar Isaac playing his papa in Dune, who was in everything else as well. And if we could get Jake Gyllenhaal in as like an uncle or something in there, we would have a wonderful little trifecta for the two of us.
That would be great. I approve.
And of course, it wasn't surprising, but Dune 2 news just came out. Any thoughts? You weren't surprised, right?
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody was surprised. Everybody was just kind of waiting for Legendary to say yes. And I think it was going to happen anyway. But it would have had to be a pretty disastrous opening to say no. But I don't know. I think they might have anyway, because they're looking at, you know, this is going to be 2023 for the second part. That's 2 full years from now. So they're certainly looking at and hoping that we are in a world that is not what the last 2 years have been, and that the next 2 years is going to be a return to normalcy, as much as that word means anything now.
Tell me what you think the chances for Dune are in
terms of the race. Yeah, I don't see a situation in which Dune doesn't really just dominate the technical categories. It's, even though we have some, you know, some big films, some blockbuster stuff like Eternals and other things that are kind of back in the Oscar race, I don't think anything can really touch Dune in those categories. But, you know, we're also in the era of the preferential ballot at the Oscars. So something like Dune is not a Best Picture winner anymore, not that kind of thing. And it's, you know, sci-fi, which the Academy has its own feelings about. So that opens the door for Belfast. And honestly, I mean, the moment that Belfast was announced for Telluride, that was it for me. It's the Best Picture front. That's it.
Your front runner. Yeah,
absolutely. That's not going to, I don't see it changing.
You do see Dune being nominated for Best Picture, of course. Yes. In the technical categories, is it No Time to Die a big competitor, or?
I think it's less of a competitor. I don't imagine it's going to play better than Skyfall, you know, which had Judi Dench and Javier Bardem getting actual, you know, acting awards nominations and stuff leading up to the Oscars. They didn't get in, but there was an appreciation and a respect for it at the Oscars that no Bond film had before. So I'm looking at it to do well in song and sound, but maybe not really much else.
The Bond franchise, in many ways, particularly in Oscar terms, is much more of a European franchise. They quite seldom make a dent at the Oscars, right? And this year, the technical Below the Line Awards, the conversation seems to be all Dune.
Yeah, it's Dune is just going to take up all the oxygen in those conversations. And I mean, you know, rightfully so. It is an impeccable
amazing
film and blockbuster. So there's no reason why it shouldn't. I mean, we have like The Matrix Resurrection coming, which looks amazing. Visually just looks insane. That could have an impact. The new Spider-Man could have an impact. We're not sure yet, but I have a hard time seeing something topple Dune in those technical categories. And so we could see like what happened with Gravity, you know, or Mad Max and the Revenant, which completely just took all of the technical wins and, you know, left the door open for, you know, screenplay, picture, stuff like that.
And you have Belfast as number one now as your best picture contender. We didn't get a chance to talk about that last time. So this is...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Kenneth Branagh's, his own story, really, his childhood story, it has made an absolute splash.
I think it's a lovely film. I've seen it twice. I really, really enjoy it. It's, you know, not my favorite film of the year, but I think it's really lovely. And like I said, the Telluride announcement, as soon as we knew that it was going to play there, that was it for me, because I will stick with the Telluride showing rule, which I'll put in quotes a little bit because Green Book sidestepped that. But even in doing so, Green Book won the TIFF People's Choice. Belfast won the TIFF People's Choice. So with both of those, it's pretty unstoppable to me.
The rest of the ones you have on your list right now are the ones we talked about. Spencer, well, in order, Belfast, The Power of the Dog, Dune, King Richard, Nightmare Alley, The Tragedy of Macbeth, Licorice Pizza, West Side Story, Spencer, and wonderfully, one of our favorites, Flea, is number 10, which is actually the Danish documentary, which is Denmark's international submission for the Oscar as well. And you also have it in Best Picture.
Mm-hmm. I'm really going to bat for that movie. I think it will make Oscar history this season. And it only needs a couple of things in order to do that. If it hits, you know, animated feature and documentary, it will make history. If it makes, you know, international feature and animated, it'll make history. But I think it's going to hit at least three of the four. I'm pushing for four. I'm hoping that.
Which is the four? Sorry, international.
So international, doc, animated, and best picture. Yeah. And we've never had a documentary nominated for best picture before. So that's why it's kind of sitting there at 10. And we do have a solid 10 this year again, which is good. We're not going to have this weird, is it going to be seven or eight or nine or what is it? I'm glad that we're back to 10. So I have high hopes for it, but I'm also cautious, which is why it kind of sits there at 10. We're at the very end of October here, and I'm just getting my October predictions out. So Best Picture will be out the Friday, the 29th. But I'm pretty sure it'll still be on there.
Well, that would be amazing. And so worthy of that. I'm really.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step we have, I guess festival season is pretty much winding down. We're coming into the precursors, right? What is going on with the Golden Globes, who were out and now they've dragged us back in?
You know, I don't think anybody should be surprised by this. It would be strange, you know, that anybody would be surprised that they were not going to do this. They were always going to do this. They have never in 78 years not held a ceremony or at least an awards announcement. There was no.
Yeah, but in 78 years, they haven't had the level of controversy that they
sure,
had.
Sure, but from all of their responses to NBC, to LA Times, to the changes that they've made, they still clearly have not like really learned or understood the impact and the seriousness of it, because they're still pretty defensive about it. And they're still basically, hey, we've done this, we're good now. So in their minds, they've done way more than what people want them to do. And that's all it was ever going to take. I'd never believed for a moment that we were not going to get the Golden Globe Awards in whatever version that they might be.
Yeah, because NBC won't be doing it, right? So they'll do what, a press conference or something on their own? Or
tentatively, that is what it would be, like they did for 2008. I don't think NBC is off the table.
Oh, you don't?
I don't. That could still happen. It's not likely, especially now that there's this fight between the Hollywood Foreign Press and the Critics Choice Association,
yeah,
which
I think. The Critics Choice Awards stepped in just for the listeners. So the Golden Globes are in January, right? And then no one thought they were going to do it since NBC's done. So the Critics Choice stepped in and took their date. And now yeah, they want it back? Or they're doing
almost,
it the same?
Almost as soon as NBC announced that they weren't going to do a telecast, Critics Choice said, okay, we'll take January 9th. We'll do it. And then there was, you know, radio silence from the Hollywood Foreign Press. And then they just announced, by the way, we're keeping January 9th and we're still doing the Golden Globes then. And so there's just been this back and forth between the Critics' Choice president.
Of this group is
of both, really. I mean, yeah. Of both.
But yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's, and that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. The Hollywood Foreign Press does not, clearly does not feel that they had to make any changes. They are only doing it for posterity and for optics. They're keeping January 9th because they want to keep things the way that they were and the way that they are.
Well, can I?
So it's kind of fascinating.
Okay. Yeah, can I ask you one thing? I mean, in terms of like publicists and art, does anyone want a Golden Globe?
That is the big question, because that's the big question. I think,
I mean,
it's November
pushing for this. I mean,
November 15th, I believe, is the deadline for networks and studios to submit their films and their TV shows, and they have to be submitted. So that's the thing, and everybody's kind of being really quiet about it.
Yeah, is that because, public? Will we know who's submitted?
They don't usually post like an eligibility list, mm-hmm. but we do usually find out, you know, like category placement and stuff like that.
I'm calling you on November 16th.
Yeah, I'm gonna find out as much as I can. But that's part of it, is that, you know, we can bash and make fun of the Golden Globes for being, you know, just craven about this, regardless of optics. But it's also studios and networks and publicists and all of that that still want it too. They want the Golden Globes to still exist, and it will be a really interesting test to see if the changes that they've implemented are enough to say, yes, we're going to go ahead and submit all of our stuff like it was normal. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, if we have, say, Netflix decides not to submit anything because it's not, you know, good enough. They were one of the first to pull out from the Globes, even though they've also been some of the biggest benefactors of the controversies of the Golden Globes. So if we see Netflix product all across nomination morning, then we know that people want,
all is forgiven.
Yeah, exactly. enough to be able to put, you know, Golden Globe winner or nominee on a poster or a trailer.
But I just think it's strange, because first of all, the controversy and all the sort of BS that's been going on there, in combination with no show, because what they were good at was the show, was the spectacle, the fun party, the much more fun party than a lot of the other award shows, the precursors are. And with neither of those,
I don't know. It's going to be fun to talk about. I'll say that I'm glad that I'm not a part of it in that sense, and that I get to just talk about it. It's, you know, it puts me in like a weird safe space, but at the same time, you know, I have to look at things from a perspective of what is my position and job in talking about this. Do I just simply report things, or do I add color commentary that gives context? And I think, you know, most people that know me, I do like color commentary.
Oh,
so.
I mean, if you're not doing the color commentary.
I do have opinions. It's so right. Weird.
Yes. Then I'm not calling anymore. We want your color commentary. But other than that, the precursors are looking pretty much as usual, right? I mean, pre-COVID, pretty
yeah,
much.
Yeah, they're a little bit.
Oscars.
They're mostly a little bit later than usual. We do have AFI Fest left in November. That's kind of the last one, and we'll see some world premieres there of films that haven't gone anywhere else yet. And then obviously we still have a handful of films that aren't going to any festival, so we're just waiting for them to be seen to have any kind of opinion on them. But yeah, otherwise we've got Gotham and Critics Awards will start in earnest in December, kind of like normal. Mm-hmm. And but like Screen Actors Guild nominations aren't till January instead of December like they normally are. Golden Globe nominations are in December like they normally are.
They are. They're all back.
Because, you know, everything's, you know, the Oscars are the end of March, which is still a month later than they kind of have been. But certainly not the end of April, like this season. So everything's moved, almost everything's moved about a month later than what we're used to seeing. So it's going to be another long season.
Yeah, and mostly talk about in-person shows.
Yes, which there are definitely going to be more of because they all take place in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has extremely strict vaccination requirements. I think we'll still have probably some reduced or limited numbers, but I think because of those requirements being in place, you know, it affords normalcy.
So I want to switch gears a bit to talk about the very tragic incidents at Rust, the Alec Baldwin film, where the tragic shooting of the cinematographer Helena Hutchins and the director who was also shot in the shoulder. I thought it was interesting is the wrong word, but it was the fact that this happened just a week or two after all this talk of the ATSI, the big possible strike from the below the line in Hollywood, the workers, and then this happened sort of like a, you know, symbolic, tragic gesture of what happens when you don't have enough money in your productions and you're not taking things seriously and not working with unions and things like that. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts about how this will reverberate in the industry and where you think this is going, what you think is going to happen with this case.
Well, I mean, the timing of it was just perfectly tragic because, like you said, it did really highlight the fight that's going on, still going on, even with, you know, some agreements in place with IATSE. And it's tough because when things like this happen, we get information in bits and pieces, and then it's either validated and corroborated or it's changes. So it's tough being in such a instant news era. Because, you know, when it first came out, we didn't really know anything. We know more and more each day. We know from the crew itself who are revealing in court documents the working conditions of this film were really, really poor. So I think it highlights the need for this union to have an extremely strong agreement. It highlights that the film industry, unlike a lot of other regular jobs, has a requirement or an expectation, I should say, of extremely long hours, very little support. And that's, you know, whether it's a blockbuster or an independent film. And that isn't to say that all are like that in any way whatsoever. But because things are so lax oftentimes, it just allows for that type of abuse to happen pretty easily. Because this is an industry like, you know, modeling or really any type of other of entertainment industry where you'll always be under the threat of, well, if you don't want to do this, there's 100 people right behind you that will take your place. And
which
so
is
you
what
do
happened here, right? We what we understand that the
it's exactly
the
what happened.
Yeah, they let all the union people go and quick as ever brought in a bunch of other people.
That's exactly right. And it's been the nature of this industry for a very, very long time is just this threat of how bad do you want it? You know, how much will you compromise your integrity and safety, you know, to work on a film in any capacity at all. And this is, you know, this is what happened on Rust. It's what happened with Scott Rudin and Harvey Weinstein. It's all the same animal of abuse and abuse of power and how people feel very vulnerable and open to it simply because they want to work in the industry.
Well, I hope that this will be, at least in the tragedy of it all, some sort of calling to people to take this seriously.
Absolutely. And the most vulnerable people are the ones that need the most protection, stunt people and everything else that are like quite literally putting their lives on the line for our entertainment.
I don't understand why we have to have live ammunition on films at all. I mean, to me, that's just one of the easiest things to just decide this is ridiculous. I mean, why even take that risk?
It seems extremely irresponsible to me. If you want to have your actor take gun training, which, you know, I think if you're going to work on a film that has a lot of firearms, I think that's crucial and important. But that would be something you do completely offset.
And before,
you know, with all safety requirements. I don't understand. Live rounds on a set, it doesn't make any logical sense. But
and finally, I have to ask you about Chappelle.
Chappelle. Yes. Oh my God. You know, it's very strange to watch somebody dig their heels in deeper and make it even worse, when there are plenty of ways that it could have been, I don't know, a great opportunity, a great chance for enlightenment and conversation. But again, it's sort of like what we talked about at the top. You have two different sides that have no meeting place because at least one of them is not even allowing it. His whole comment, I won't bend to anyone's demands. And then immediately after that, set up requirements with even talking to him, with having, you know, trans activists talk to him. And he's just not seeing.
Yeah, they were supposed to meet him when he wanted them to be met. And they had to say that Hannah Gatsby wasn't funny, which was one of the requirements he had for meeting.
Any one of these things would be horrible. All of them together is just kind of insanity to me. Hannah Gatsby is one of the most brilliant comedians that is working, and not understanding that, and just invoking her is just such a bizarre way.
He's not taking it serious. When you add something like that at the end, it's just
he's just working on a level of hypocrisy that is pretty lousy. And you know, Ted Sarandos of Netflix is not doing a really good job either. He's doing terrible.
How do you think that Sarandos will handle this going forward, and what do you see, any implications? Will there be any changes at Netflix, or is it just too much money to even?
It is a lot of money, but I mean, by Netflix standards, it's not really that much money. And any kind of controversy always improves numbers. And if you're just a bottom line company, you know, you're going to see that all of this controversy is just going to boost the viewing of the special. And ultimately that is the goal anyway. Because I think as a CEO or as anybody, you can sort of make the argument that, hey, it's being seen by a very wide audience of people, which, you know, creates the conversation itself. There are lots of ways to sidestep and excuse without actually having to do anything and putting it, you know, on the audience and on the viewer to make up their mind, which I get, I understand that, but it does also allow, you know, a studio or an individual to not really have to do anything or stand for anything.
But he does have a bunch of incredibly talented and very powerful talent who is very much against this, who are at Netflix. And what kind of power could they wield in sort of saying that we won't accept this?
Well, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that would instigate some change, because Netflix has really, over the last few years, done a stunning job of bringing in huge, huge A-list talent, directors and actors for projects. And again, it'll be about either bottom line or integrity on all sides. And if there are people that have had a relationship with Netflix or have a future one and want to put their foot down, then they will, or they won't. because it doesn't seem like Dave Chappelle is interested in any type of actual conversation about this. And I do say this as somebody who has been a very big fan of his. He is a tremendously insightful and interesting comedian, and his commentary on society is always aces. So this entire,
if one he did on George Floyd right after.
Yeah. The 8 minutes, 46 seconds.
That was incredible.
Absolutely. And his TV show was amazing, and it was biting, and it was satire, and it was really fantastic, but it always punched up. And as soon as you, as a comedian, start really punching down, you've lost, you might have a core audience that supports what you're saying, but you've lost the upper hand in being an observational comedian, really. Because that's not how Richard Pryor was. It's not how George Carlin was. And people like to make these weird free speech comparisons to those two. Yeah. Have you ever even listened to these guys? What are you even talking about? That's bullshit. So I hope that he can maybe find some clarity in the things that he's saying and how, and I just hope that he can. Yeah. Yeah. Why does he keep digging his heels in? Why is he so actually obsessed with trans people in his comedy now? What's even going on there?
Why? It just seems like you can't let it go. And
yeah, it's sort of like, this is going to be a big leap, but it's sort of like Trump, who, you know, would only speak directly to his base and feed his base the things that they wanted, and there was no room to offer anything else at that point. And I feel like Chappelle is sort of narrowing down his scope to a point where he's not going to have really much to say.
Let's hope he gets some clarity, and we'll see what
I hope so.
Eric, as usual, all very interesting and great. And I'll definitely want to talk to you within a month there. I am so curious about where this Golden Globe thing is going. It seems like it's going to be the talk of the season.
Yes, right after AFI, which it ends on the 14th, we've got that deadline for the Golden Globes on the 15th. So yeah, let's meet back up after that and see what happens.
You'll have time for me then. I'll
call. Oh, yes. Then.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Anne-Marie Kelly. Wild Precious Life is a podcast about dreaming big, digging in and connecting across distance, division, and loss. In each episode, I talk with prize-winning writers, musicians, and wanderers who remind all of us how we can make the most of the time we have. So meet me here. Let's walk and talk and dream and discover what it means to be wild, precious, and brave.